Is that the sex music that you guys were playing 2 hours ago at the end of last night?
It was Halloween. I wouldn't be surprised. I know that poor Nat wrapped up his gig last night, probably around 4 or 5 this morning, and still managed to make it into the studio on time.
Same
That's
with Jack.
Dedication.
They had like 300 people at their party.
Oh, no kidding.
Night. Yeah, we've had an hour of sleep. It's going to be the best show ever.
Ever. Meanwhile, I've had plenty of sleep, and so I'm feeling really chirpy.
The one tag is going to be like there were no tags. We could not glean any tags from today's conversation. Well, it was Halloween. I mean, that's a big night, huh?
I'm kind of over it, but I know for younger people, it's still a big deal. Certainly a big deal for my daughter, although she hasn't gotten to the age yet where like Jack and Nat and EJ and you know where they go to parties and they have really a good time and everybody dresses up and stuff.
She's still in like two people on the opposite ends of the gymnasium dance floor.
Yeah, kind of. Although that's all they talked about, as I told you, Patrick, before we started the show, which, by the way, is the main course on Heritage Radio Network.
Yeah, I'm Patrick Martin.
I'm Katie Kiefer, and we're sponsored today by the Hearst Ranch.
Hearst, excellent beef out
excellent
of California.
Beef program, yeah.
All grass-fed.
Anyway, so they did the big candy grab in Delilah's father's building, which is a big multi-story building in the Upper West Side, and then they slithered over to my house soaking wet because there was like a really raucous thunderstorm for about 15 minutes. I thought it was fireworks, but it was thunder.
No, I love it. It all goes into the, Halloween is the one day where like it's okay for kids to like spray a house in shaving cream.
Oh, yeah. Throw some eggs around.
Yeah,
you
it's like a gelable offense, but like on Halloween, you kind of let it go. And plus, it's a Day of the Dead. All the ghosts
Absolutely.
Are coming up.
Yeah, yeah. No, I
like
love the holiday.
Of the,
but the dressing up part of it, I seem to have kind of given up that part of my life. Because as I said to Curtis earlier the other day, I said I costume myself every day anyway.
Oh my God. I role play a lot,
dressed.
Actually.
Really?
So, and then, of course, Roberta's here, had an unbelievable
event.
Amazing.
So event. Sorry I missed it.
It was a bike rally.
Yeah.
With little mini motorbikes.
Yeah,
and they
had built
to
a
jump
track.
And,
it was pretty amazing. It was madness and mayhem, I understand.
And Brandon was the MC, and he was dressed in this hockey uniform that's right here.
Oh, yeah.
And he was, like, spitting beer in the bikers' faces or tackling them. It was very, very funny. It was kind of like a velodrome, in a way.
Well, that's sort of Curtis's vision for the Brooklyn Velodrome, which will be called Velo City or Velocity. He wants to have teams, who mm-hmm. have different sort of ways of riding their bikes. Like some are going to be like dirt bikes and some of them are going to be really fast racing bikes wearing the streamlined skin suit. And the other ones are going to be wearing armor. And then there's going to be like a bunch of bikers who ride in tandem, like four or six across the track that you have to like maneuver around. And yeah, it's going to be
velodromes
wild.
Velodromes are big though. It's like bigger than a football field.
Yeah, well, I don't know how big this one is, but
we could have like a test velodrome or mm-hmm. something. Well, it's an interesting show. Today we're going to be talking about butchering. We have a celebrity butcher
we
from
do.
New York.
It's really interesting how suddenly butchering has become the trendy thing. So our guest today is Tom Mylan.
Hi, I'm trendy.
And you look so trendy. Your trend is just like glowing, like radioactive, man. And it's to me, having been in the butchering business myself back in the 80s and early 90s, when there were, there were still three or four butchers around on the Upper West Side. And it was kind of one of those neighborhood shops, like your favorite mm-hmm. neighborhood barber shop or something. And then suddenly they all went away almost simultaneously. And now it's a regrowing industry in Brooklyn. That's pretty much what happened.
It's exploding back onto the scene.
It's exploding back onto the scene after the rents exploded it out of Manhattan. There's only a few left in Manhattan, although there's still a few real old-timey guys out there.
Well, what happened? I mean, why did those guys go out of business? Were they
rent.
Not really?
It was the rent. Mm-hmm. I mean, for the business that I was working with, they lost their lease and the landlord wouldn't renew. He wanted to put in a gap. Mm-hmm. In the space, he wanted to take over three storefronts and put in a Gap or a Duane Reade or something like that. This was on Broadway at 90th Street.
Just to play devil's advocate, I mean, were some of these butchers like not adjusting to the times or charging enough or diversifying in a way? Or
incredible as it may seem to you, Patrick, the whole concept of grass-fed versus grain-fed, mm-hmm. Organically grown meats, all that kind of stuff, it was not even a blip on the radar yet. Mm-hmm. And this was in, let's see, my kid was born in 96. So this was in the late 80s, early 90s that I worked there. And the shop closed around 1997. And
what shop did you work for?
It was Shimmick's? Called the Broadway Butcher.
Oh, Broadway Butcher.
And it was run by a Frenchman named Michel Guiton, who had been my chef. He was actually a cook. He was a chef. And he taught me how to cook. And he and his wife, who was an ex-Broadway dancer, had decided that they would open this shop. And he had brought in a couple of guys that he had worked with for years and years, and including another American named Paul Retter, who still works as a butcher over on the east side with Lenny Simchak. But we had this really rocking little crew, and I did prepared foods for them. I ran a line of prepared foods so you could come in.
That you made at your house or that you made
totally
there with
illegal.
Them?
Yep. No, I made them in my house and I trucked them down there every day at 4 o'clock. And, you know, so you could buy a lamb chop from Michelle and you'd buy some ratatouille from me or, you know, something like that. It was really a sweet little thing. We had so much fun. It was the best job I've ever had. I worked my ass off. Oh, my God.
Well, Tom, when you got into butchering, I mean, was it the lack of butchers that kind of made you want to do it? Or was it always something you just had an affinity towards?
Are you asking? So
butchering. Like, were you like, God, there needs to be more butchers. Like, I want to get a butcher.
Yeah,
because
you were a restaurant cook, right?
No, I was I was a manager at Marlowe & Sons. I did all the purchasing for the little specialty shop that they had in the front there, and then I also...
You went from being a purchasing agent to being a butcher? That's an interesting transition.
I was also...
Not obvious.
I was also... I wore a lot of hats. I was kind of their special projects guy. I did all of their American cheese programs for the restaurants, and I also was one of the main editors for the Diner Journal, which is their magazine. Mm.
That's a very nice little journal. Magazine they do.
But I got ambushed. I got drafted. I didn't make the decision. The decision made me.
No kidding. Yeah. So what happened? So they said, you know what? We need to start buying whole animals as what? Economy of scale for the restaurants?
No, what they were trying to do is figure out a way to make local sustainable meat less expensive.
Mm-hmm. And that is all of our goal.
And the best way that they could figure out was to start buying animals whole, because when you buy an animal whole, you know, instead of paying, you know, $15 a pound or something like that for a dried strip loin, you can buy the whole animal for, say, you know, $3.50 or $3.75 a pound hanging weight, and then you can make, you know, if you have a crafty restaurant crew, they can make all sorts of delightful things out of all the different bits and pieces of it.
And that,
what
that
about
was a
the
sort of...
ground? I mean, that is the big challenge, right? I mean, what secrets did you guys come up with about how to use all the ground meat that's generated from, like, a whole cow, for instance?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, one of the restaurants that was involved was the Diner, which has always been sort of renowned as, you know, having a really amazing burger, and we just went about making it that much more amazing. If we did have any other ground meat left over, I mean, obviously, we'd go into you know, meatballs or, you know, something like that.
Pasta sauce, yeah, absolutely.
We did a lot of specials with ground short rib meatballs, which were really delicious.
Now, let me ask you this, because I actually had a little conversation with Bill Telepan, because one of the things that I was thinking about writing an article about was the sort of rise of the burger as kind of this, you know, gourmet item. All of a sudden, it's been elevated to a much greater and loftier status than it used to enjoy. And part of that is due to this trend that a lot of chefs have been pursuing, which is to grind these proprietary blends where you have, like, you know, one third of it is short ribs and one third is brisket and one third is, you know, chuck or whatever. And, you know, I know how to cook. So, like, I don't think of short ribs as something that cooks up real fast. Like, that's the kind of meat that's, it's got a stringy, tough muscle. It's you know, it generally needs to be braised, so it's cooked slowly,
there's a lot
low
of collagen.
Temperature. Yeah. And so how do you grind up a piece of short rib and have it not be sort of tough and
bouncy?
Yeah. Rubbery, yes, exactly.
I mean, basically, like, if you cut anything up into small enough pieces, it's gonna be fine. Mm-hmm. That said, the
But you also don't get the same groovy flavor, I don't think, when it's not cooked for a nice long time, right? Or you do? You feel like the flavor is still as succulent as it is when it's cooked in a slow way with some moist heat?
No, I'm not going to, you know, lie to anybody and say, oh, it's exactly the same. It's not the same, but you do get, you know, the the fat content in there, which right. is like,
which is what it largely gives it flavor, right? Because yeah, it gives it flavor. Fat is what gives meat flavor,
right? And it's not just flavor; it's also, you know, a matter of texture. So you get that mm-hmm. nice, like, you know, that nice mouth feel. You can like mm-hmm. cook out a meatball in a sauce, or you know, however you're going to do it, and you'll get this really amazing mouth feel from all that fat that's in there. And we right. definitely did not spare any fat.
So,
not for words, dieters.
You weren't short really, rib meatball. You weren't trimming off those short ribs. You were like just letting it go with all of its outside fat.
Yeah. Yeah. And what was your? Right. I mean, burgers usually range between like 70% lean and 30% fat. Or I mean, what is the general ratio of fat to lean meat like in the average American burger?
I think the average American burger is probably more like 75-25, 75 mm-hmm. lean to 25 fat. You know, I imagine there's a lot of places that maybe do, you know, something that's more like 65-35 if it's an inexpensive. I think the reason why, you know, I don't know, I feel like there's these two burger camps. There's the camp that really likes the, you know, $12, $14 burger, which is super deluxe. And then there's a camp that is definitely...
the ground meat that you buy in the supermarket.
Well, I wouldn't say that. What I would say is, like, you know, then there's a group of people that, you know, say the best burger that they've ever had is at some Greasy Spoon mm-hmm. somewhere in the Midwest that cost them $1.50. And I think the interesting thing that those two burgers have in common is the fact that they're both really fatty. I mean, if you're getting right. a really cheap burger, it obviously has a lot more fat ground into it because of the way the packing industry works. Like that's mm-hmm. their thing that they're trying to get rid of is all this fat, and you can't sell it by itself and make any money off it. You make a lot more if you can grind it into the burger meat.
We actually talked about that yesterday. I mean, the Times wrote a really good, what I liked about that E. coli piece that they did is they really broke it down to the price repeatedly throughout yeah. the article, and that the fat, like the trim, I mean, we always get for commodity,
right?
You know, like with the pork. So any place that would buy the trim for even 1 cent more, you know, so you get a burger with nine different, you know, from nine different places, Uruguay and all that, just to save those extra fats. Hello, our third co-host is here, Shauna.
Hello.
Who actually, I saw your video on butchering. That was a cool video you sent.
Yeah. No, it was fun. It was a lot of fun to do.
Well, we'll talk about
that. Yeah, I got to check that out.
So, Tom, tell us. I mean, I was lucky enough to bump into you as you were, you know, doing construction on the front of your new storefront. And I was like amazed, A, that I now have a zombie backup, you know, to my own house, because it was like a vast, amazing place. And I was wondering if maybe you could break it down for our listeners, like the various components of this like multifaceted community business of yours.
Yeah, so the new project / anti-zombie fortress that we're building right now is going to be called the Brooklyn Kitchen Labs. It will house our butcher shop, The Meat Hook, inside. But
The Meat Hook?
The Meat Hook. That's a great name.
Yeah, really, Tom.
but it's a 7,000 square foot facility. It's going to wow. have 5,000 square feet that will be open to the public, and 2,000 square feet of office and
refrigeration.
office and production space. And basically, you know, it's on Meeker Avenue in North Williamsburg, and you'll walk in the front door. We have a massive glass roll up, and you'll come in either through that when it's sunny, or you'll come in through the door on the side, and you come up a ramp, and you'll see the daily specials on chalkboards that are inset into these walls that have the Meat Hook and the Brooklyn Kitchen logos. And then you'll immediately see off to your right our bulk room, where we'll be offering bulk local grains, legumes, olive oil, stuff like that. Obviously, the olive oil is not local.
All with wood, right? That you had found actually in the basement. You recycled
no,
that.
Actually, yeah. The bulk room is clad with the floorboards. I'm not sure how old the floorboards are, but I do know that they were fastened to the second story floor with hand-forged square nails. So
cool.
They're pretty old, and yeah. we really couldn't bring ourselves to throw them out. And our incredibly wonderful and insane welder, this guy named Macumbo, was like, "Man, you can't throw those out. You should put them on the side of the bulk room, and you know, rub them down with some oil and they'll look amazing. And so that's what we did. We recycled the planks from the second floor.
Way
so
to go.
That's what you'll see when you walk in to the right. And then once you enter into the space up the ramp, you'll see the sales floor will have, your typical – or well, not – you'll see your atypical vast arrangement of kitchen, you know, cooking goods and supplies. And then if you go straight back, you'll see the counter of our butcher shop, which is about 30 feet wide, and we have a great big huge walk-in.
What's the actual material for the cutting, or like what do people – is it wood? Or, I mean, where do you cut your meats? Like what will people see – on what surface do you cut or do your butchering, like in front of people?
Well, the butchering is going to actually take place behind the counters, but you'll be behind the coolers where the meat will be displayed. But we're going to do all of our butchering on an 8-foot by 3-foot John Boo's butcher block table that we had custom made for us.
Wow.
And
sweet. Who's John Boo's?
John Boo's is a really famous, like the highest quality and most famous producer of butcher block. In the United States today, anyway.
Where is he?
You know,
where is the? I mean, is it East Coast or?
I believe it is Illinois, but I actually didn't. I wasn't involved in the ordering of that. I just like told them how big and how tall I wanted it, and someone else ordered it. But I think they're in the Midwest. If I Ohio
makes sense.
So Tom, you're gonna get like whole animals into your establishment.
Yeah, exclusively.
And you'll
whole
be
animals.
And you'll be breaking them down into the primal cuts and
yes.
And then you're going to have a teaching component there too, right?
So right. So that's basically once you come in and you see the butcher shop and everything. Off to the left is a 1,200 square foot teaching kitchen, which is 2 stories tall. It's a big brick cube of exposed brick. It's a really beautiful room. It's got skylights and that's what we're calling lab number one. And that will have a full teaching kitchen, with a great big island where, you know, everyone in the class can sit around the island on stools and watch, you know, the cooking demonstration or the butchering demonstration, as it were.
Uh-huh. So you're going to be teaching cooking and butchering. It's not just going to be exclusively butchering.
Right. And I will not be the only one person teaching classes. Yeah. Obviously we're going to be bringing people in, from throughout the Brooklyn food community to chefs and makers and what Millicent Soros from
Egg.
Yeah, actually she's not.
She
at
just
Egg.
Left. Right.
She just left. She's actually going to go join Dennis's group of pirates over at the Roebling Tea Room. But she was originally from Queens Highway. But she likes to call that sort of thing the wee tinker. So we're going to have a lot of wee tinkers in there teaching a lot of really bizarre things, including beer brewing. We're also going to be the only beer brewing supply that you can get to by train in the five boroughs. There is one out in Queens, but you can only get to it by car.
Say what is that? Beer brewing?
Beer brewing and winemaking supplies. We're going to have a full range of that.
Oh, wow.
And we're
also micro brew, like people who brew at home and all that, they can buy all the equipment.
Right, exactly. And we're going to have Garrett Oliver from Brooklyn Brewery come
great
in. And he's really amazing. He's going to come in and he's going to teach some beer pairings with food. And we'll be doing that in concert with a yet to be unnamed chef from the neighborhood. And we're also going to be having one of the brewmasters from Brooklyn Brewery teaching brewing classes, as well as people who have been doing the homestyle beer brewing for 10 or 15 years. We're going to get a lot of those kind of people as well to teach classes.
Beer goes so well with them. Interesting, Garrett, in his tastings, that he used to do for Slow Food, he would say, people always talk about how wine like cuts against or contrasts with food, whereas beer, it like goes along with it,
right? It like harmonizes with it. It's not in a, it's not at a 90-degree angle.
Yeah, exactly.
It works better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you guys have interesting beers at your place.
They change quite often. Our manager is a beer geek in a certain way, and he's.
It's a tall one with the fizz in it. It's served in the tall glass with the lemon. Is it?
Oh, that's the Pin Shandy. That's our head bartender made a cocktail with a ginger-infused Blue Coat gin with a Pilsner, and it's like 2 drinks in one.
It's very like champagne. It's like a mimosa beer.
It's only about a shot of the gin, so it's like 1 ounce of the gin with the beer. So it's like having a So it's a like shot a, with a beer.
It's like a beer. like a fancy weird version of the Caribbean of a boiler shandy. Maker.
Yes, okay. And, but it's really 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 good and it's great summertime drinking. And two of those put you on your ass. Huh. And that's hard for that to happen for me.
That's saying a lot. Well, we should say we're sponsored by Hearst Ranch. This who's great to sponsor us. This is
Rosebud.
Exactly. we are here at Roberta's, which is a great restaurant located at 261 Moore Street. And one of the things we're talking about with Tom Mylan is teaching. And I know that you spent some time at a local butcher here in New York State called Fleischer's.
Yeah, they taught me how to cut meat. I was really good friends with Josh and Jessica, who own Fleischer's, mm-hmm. Long before I ever got drafted to become a butcher. So it was pretty natural that they would, if I was going to learn how to do it, right. That they would teach me. So I basically moved in with them for about a month and a half and then, went to work every day and learned the rudiments of butchering. You can't learn to be a butcher in a week, or 6 weeks, but, and then I would go back on my days off and learn whatever I could more. But the problem was is that, obviously they could only teach me a certain amount because I could only be up there for a brief period of time. And so I was looking around the city to try to find butchering classes to get sort of another perspective on it. And there weren't any that were open to the public, FCI and CIA and places like that.
But you had to be a student of that whole school.
Or
cough up the big bucks to take a course.
Well, no.
There weren't literally no courses.
It was just part of the overall
They were not
program.
Offer them to the public. They were only for people who were on the career track and paying $60,000 a year and going through the whole program. And that was actually the impetus for teaching the classes, which ended up being the impetus for the opening of the new lab. So,
I just want to ask one last question just while we're on this and then Kitty, but apprenticing, can you break down the grammar of that? Like what, for butchering, how long does a regular home chef need to study? I mean, what if people want to be able to buy maybe not whole carcasses, but let's say a whole bone-in shoulder, like a 19-pound piece and to learn how to process that stuff, should they plan on a week or a month or,
It really depends what they want to do. I mean, if you just want to bone out a shoulder, you could come in and take one of our Pig Butchering 101 classes, which, it lasts for about two and a half hours and come away with a decent understanding of how to do it. And you'll have to do a little bit of trial and error, but ultimately it's a pork shoulder. It's not like you're trying to take out a tenderloin or, something like that. So you're dealing with something that is a lot more inexpensive and a lot more sort of, I'm not going to say durable.
Forgiving.
Yeah, exactly. So that you can sort of teach yourself. Where it gets tricky are, the charcuterie elements of it. There's a lot of, subtleties of, ways you can do things more right or more wrong. And, you're not going to obviously totally screw up sausage or something like that, but there's a lot of ways that you can make your sausage better. And that takes a lot longer. Obviously learning to break down beef and just the whole process of handling beef and lamb and stuff like that will take a significantly longer time. But
And how long did you apprentice at Fleischer's, more or less? It was you said 6 weeks?
It was about 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then there was a lot of phone calls. I would be once I got back and started being the butcher, I would call them and be okay, so I have a pig in front of me. What was the first cut? How many vertebrae? how many ribs do I count down? Yeah. Actually, the first pig that I broke down before I actually went up there to start apprenticing, and I broke it down with a phone in one hand and a saw in the other. Josh was on the other end, and he was like, all right, so 5 ribs in. All right, so cut there, and then just cut down to which was pretty hilarious.
It's funny.
For my first time butchering, I looked online.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was like, where do I cut this again? The first half pig was that half pig you sent me.
Oh yeah,
destroyed it.
You butchered it.
I butchered it. I destroyed it. But then I was okay, never again. Let me figure out how to.
What
do this.
What I always was curious about, when we would get, because when I was working in this butcher shop, we would get. I mean, I think cows are much more challenging than pigs.
They're just heavy.
They're just big.
They're heavy, and their pieces are really huge. So we would get in an enormous piece of beef that was included like the sirloin and then various other components. And it would just be this big sort of cryovac'd anonymous piece of beef. And somehow our head butcher, Paul, knew exactly where to cut through the muscle to be able to turn it into the sirloin steaks. And then something else would be something else.
The ear strip.
It was, no, it was further down because it wasn't part of the rib cage structure. It was like over the,
right. You're talking about the drop loin, which is the sirloin, yeah, and what's called the short loin, which includes the tenderloin and the, and
yeah, I mean, the steaks, no big deal. I mean, that, you know, that's pretty straightforward. You see the ribs, you see the, where it's, you know, but the sirloin, you'd get this really big, massive piece, or the chuck roll is another one. Like, I went to this demonstration a couple of years ago that the National Cattlemen's Beef Association put on, trying to get chefs involved in using sort of offcuts and more of the chuck roll, because that's what ends up being a lot of ground beef. You know, like, you can only sell so much stew beef, right? Mm-hmm. So they were trying to, you know, teach chefs that you could seam out these various different pieces and kind of sell them as like, you know, boneless short ribs or something like that. Now, they didn't cook up at all like traditional short ribs or sirloin tip or whatever you want to call it. They were challenging pieces to work with. And so they had four or five different chefs come in. They had Steve Schmoller from Cleveland, who was sort of the MC.
Right, he was, what was it called, chef direct? Or what did he have?
He had something like that, yeah.
For Cisco,
and he's
right?
the one who's doing, yeah, he's the one who's doing that crop scene in Cleveland and Columbus, where he's gotten all these regional farmers connected with Cisco and then connected those to local restaurants so that, you know, it raises the sort of agricultural money scene for
basically
all the local
guys. Gets them to redirect their truck for like 3 hours a week and they can do all this good. It's amazing.
Exactly. It's a phenomenal program. But anyway, so they had all these different pieces of meat. And the thing that struck me was that, you know, there's more to it than just cutting out these rib steaks or these New York strip steaks. Or it's like when you see these really large pieces of meat that weigh about 30 or 40 pounds, like the chuck roll is a big piece. You know, you got to figure out, it's not just obvious where you seam that out. It's like a lot of times you're cutting across the nerves and across the tendons.
Well, you just have to know where everything is. You have to like have the gestalt of the animal in your brain, and you have to understand the like the musculature. I mean, you have to be an anatomist to like to do that sort of like, you know, if, I hate the term artisan butchery because it means like it to me it sounds like, oh yeah, like I'm way more special than like
it somebody
demeans
else.
The guy
the
stop and
yeah,
shop.
It demeans other butchers, and it's like, you know, it's an amazing vocation, and we should all be thankful that there's people out there doing it. But anyway, but I mean that you know, if you want to be an artisan butcher, you have to know where all of those seams lie, and you have to be an anatomist. That said, you know, you can also, you know, cut everything up on a bandsaw. So it's yes. like the thing about butchering is it's as complicated as you want to make it or as simple as you want to make
it. But when you cut it up on a bandsaw, you're not necessarily going to get you're going to get sort of a variety of meats within one piece of meat, if you know what I mean.
Right.
If you cut something on a bandsaw, you could get a muscle that's running in one direction that's next to a muscle that's running in another direction.
Or more importantly,
and find something that's going to end up not being able to be sliced in any way that's normal for a consumer.
Right. I mean, there's basically everything that you see at, like, you know, the typical grocery store these days. I mean, you know, about 90% of it is just cut on a bandsaw and just thrown
box
in a tray.
Beef. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, and what you're getting when you get a slice of, you know, you were talking about the chuck earlier. When you get a slice of chuck, yeah, you get there is the slice of chuck eye in the middle of that, but around that you get all these tough cuts. So
the bycatch
right.
of the bandsaw.
Well, yeah. And the problem is like, yeah, it was really easy to cut that up, but you're not like the only part that's going to be good and tender and tastes like a ribeye is going to be the part on the very inside, and all this ancillary stuff around it should have been made in the
trimmed
stew
off
beef.
And made into stew beef or braised. Yeah.
Are the breeders different? Like, do you ever notice that one farmer will bring you a cow that's just a different kind of cow and its musculature is different, or, you know, it surprises you just because of the shape and size of it?
Yeah. Like every breed is a little bit different. In the United States, we're obviously very sort of British oriented. Like most of the genetics that are out there in America are like, you know, some sort of version of the British steer, whether it be, you know, the
Black Angus or Hereford or those are the two main breeds.
Devon.
Right?
I mean, now you're seeing a lot more stuff coming in, like the Devons. They're bringing in a lot of Devon genetics and crossing that up because they were never, you know, especially when you're talking about grass finish stuff, they were never diluted. They were never bred like to finish on grain. So they're bringing in a lot of these other genetics. But I mean, the one cow that steer that looked significantly different than any of the other ones I'd cut up was actually a French breed called a Limousine.
Oh, I've heard of those.
I've heard of
those. Limousine.
Yeah, and they have really, really wide loins. Like the loins are like probably a third wider.
It's like a limo versus a regular car.
Yeah.
You know, I actually wrote a piece.
They got a big back.
Because they're using Limousin for veal. And they and the woman who was raising the Strauss family, which was raising really fantastic meadow raised veal, they had gone through hundreds of different, you know, cows to figure out which breed was going to be the best. And they used the Limousin veal because the veal is so outstanding. But she said that the cow, the full grown cow was not as great eating as the veal.
Well, to be fair, the one that I got was actually like the people that raise it. Obviously, it was their first or second year raising them, and there's a pretty steep learning curve if you're trying to do stuff exclusively with grass. There's a lot of tinkering with genetics. There's a lot of pasture management that is super critical. There's a lot of finishing items that are really critical. So I have to say that the animal that we got wasn't the most outstanding steer that I've ever seen, but that's what I noted.
Was it just tougher, the meat?
No, it was...
when they do something wrong, I was going to ask, what happens?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so the biggest thing that people who do grass do wrong is they don't get their animals enough food, or they've been weaned off their mother too early. If animals aren't allowed to wean off naturally, and that's a process that takes 8 to 10 months, not all of their stomachs develop, and that means that if their stomachs aren't developed, they're not going to be able to convert that grass as efficiently. Into, you know, energy, muscle, fat. So that's one place that they can screw up. And the other place is, you know, just having poor pasture or like pasturing them incorrectly. But anyway, what that means is they're not getting enough food.
But Tom, go ahead.
And if they aren't putting on a pound and a half a day,
something's wrong.
Well, no, they actually switch over to this different type of metabolism. Oh. And so when you get that grass-fed steak that is really lean and it's got this weird dark color and it tastes gamey, you know, it's because the steer was actually not getting enough nourishment and they had sort of reverted back to their sort of, you know, aboriginal...
Survival.
Yeah, so their survival metabolism.
Interesting.
Where they're not...
That answers so many questions
it
for
does,
me.
It does, right?
Yeah. Me too. I've worked with many different cuts of grass-fed beef and... I'm like, why is this one so different than I mean, I couldn't understand. That's exactly how I feel.
And yet I've had grass-fed beef that I think is just so much better than any of the corn-finished beef. Because it tastes really beefy.
Seems like the compromise that people, most of the chefs that I interact with, they're just like, we like grass-fed, we understand that, we need to get on that kick, but like at the same time, could you corn-finish it?
The corn-finish because it makes the meat sweeter and it gives it more marbling and therefore it's more tender.
Is that all it is? Is it a taste thing at the end or is it a fattening up thing? Believe in corn-finishing? You believe in grass-fed all the way?
Oh, no, I'm not one of those like, oh, it has to be grass-fed or it's shit. Okay. Like, you know, I'm not a snob about that sort of thing. The thing of it is like everything can be done right and everything can be done wrong. Like when we're talking in broad generalizations, we're saying a grain finished animal versus a grass finished animal, but there are so many different quality levels. I mean, obviously, you know, there's, you know, just because something is, you know, pork that's fed grain, you know, there's the incredibly crap stuff that you can get, or there's the stuff that you guys sell, you know. And
well, actually, I don't know if our animals eat the proper grains. I mean, in a weird way, I think more animals that we think of in America are actually eating the McDonald's equivalent, you know, but for animal food.
Well, for commodity pigs, they're eating a lot of leftovers from distilleries.
Well,
mash from distilleries.
We have so much trouble just with the breeds and selling the stuff. I mean, if we were to think about the feed, like we're probably a couple of years before we can even say, how are we going to get organic grains? I mean, it's just so much. I just sometimes I fear our animals are not eating as well as they should be, mm-hmm. but that we're years
away. Do you
away
know
from,
what they're eating, though?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same stuff, you know, that the feedlots, you know, exist, you know, with occasional exceptions. But, you know, I think our next big thing is
but,
to,
yeah,
what
but
are they eating?
Feedlots are feeding animals like candy. And, I mean, if you're to believe what the press has written, I don't know. I'd love to give them an opportunity to refute that. But supposedly they're eating a lot of, you know, refuse from
well,
human tables.
I mean, I still think they're just probably eating all maybe a genetically modified, you know, thing that if you trace back 50 years to Monsanto, I don't know. I mean, it's... something I don't hear or read about that often is like, what are the bulk of our animals eating and what are the sustainable ones eating? You know, I think mm-hmm. probably here in New York State, it's a lot better. But in the Midwest, you're just so reliant on that source of feed, you know.
Well,
the
and also
cost
the
level.
Volume of the animal, the volume of numbers is so much greater than they are in the small farmers in the Northeast and the Atlantic states. But Tom, to go back one for 1 second to the issue that you brought up yeah. about weaning animals. I know. Let's get into the real nitty gritty here.
The grammar.
You really
just real quick. What I was actually saying with the like the you know when I started talking about your pigs and everything, everything's complicated. Obviously, your pigs are a lot better than like pigs that are and they're fed. More or less the same thing, but your pigs are a lot better because yeah. they're raised differently. They're different breeds, whatever. Everything's complicated. There is no, yeah, like, oh, pork know. Tastes like this. It's like, no, there's a spectrum, and the same yeah. thing with grain finished and the same thing with grass finished. There's a way to do it right, and there's yeah. a way to do it wrong. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, most people out there are doing it wrong.
Well, anyway, when you wean an animal too early, which you were saying yeah. has an impact on
it
the
has
overall
a huge impact.
Finish. In the commodity beef market, how do they, I mean, they surely they're weaning their animals way too early. Or no, they're leaving them.
Them. Don't they hand feed them? Or they don't
feed them.
In the commodity beef industry, I doubt it.
I think that they don't. They take them away from the mother like within the first 3 days.
I actually don't know that much about the industrial cow calf operation. I do know that's so basically the process is you have an animal that is at a cow calf operation for about you know between eight to ten months.
Yeah.
And then it's moved to the feedlot, and it's usually slaughtered around 16 months old.
Yes.
That's mostly because they can only live for about 6 months on the feedlot, the way that they're
yeah.
done.
They're so unhealthy.
Yeah, well, they're also, so unhealthy that their life expectancy on the feedlot is about 6 months.
But also they've reached the size that is appropriate. I mean, one of the reasons why the feedlot thing came into, yeah, that the feedlot came into play was because they wanted to create a consistent product that was the same size so that when they were cutting it up for supermarket chains and stuff like that, they got the same yield off of every animal. I mean, right.
I heard
you know, that's
that,
part of the industrialization process.
Animals were eaten a lot smaller, even though they were produced in smaller numbers and in more places, that back in the day, like in the 1900s, for instance, they liked smaller animals. They would just kill them before they reached the sizes that they reach now. Is that true? Do you know? I just heard someone say that,
I don't know that much about like the age at which animals were slaughtered. If anything, the things that I've read led me to believe that if an animal was slaughtered for like, you know, for steaks or for, you know, beef that would be sold and not just consumed on the farm, that they would actually grow them out significantly older than we're doing now.
And bigger, they weighed more or they weighed the same.
They would probably weigh the same because actually we've been breeding our animals bigger and bigger. The Angus that we have in the United States is about a third bigger than the smaller Angus that you'll see in the British Isles. Like most of the British beef are, you know, if you get one that has a carcass weight of more than, you know, hot weight carcass weight of, you know, more than 700 pounds, you've got a real big one. Mm-hmm. In Britain, but here it's
more,
you know,
like 13, right?
The biggest one I've ever cut up was a 1130. And that was a black Angus. But that's
the whole thing, not just one side.
Yeah, that's the
The whole beast. Yeah.
The whole steer. That's the slaughtered hot weight, like after
so
it's
gone.
Hanging
going
hanging
back
weight.
A little bit, you said that you don't have a preference of grass-fed to corn-fed to, or you do have a preference, you're just not really.
No, I don't. I am not a snob about it. I definitely have my predilections. I do, my grass-finished guy that I have, I mean, they are like white trash Kobe. I mean, they are insane. And he's just the best guy at raising animals.
Kobe.
He's the best guy at raising beef that I have. right now. I'm sure at some point in the near future, I'll get a grainfish guy that maybe can do it even more insane than he can. But he's my favorite guy right now. But before that, before I got him, my favorite guy was grainfished.
Uh-huh.
So it's really, the point I was trying to make, was that we're speaking broad generalizations when we say grass uh-huh. and grain. It's really like, what's the end quality? How good is your farmer at raising an animal to be the best it can be? And like, and that's always going to be my favorite, is the best animal with the best genetics, and the animal that is raised to the proper weight, the proper.
So you're not doing local?
It's terroir.
Oh, no, we're doing local.
Terroir and local.
We only do local. Okay, I only deal with farms that I've been to.
Only farms that you've been to. But yeah. Isn't it true that grass-fed beef in New York, it can't be grass-finished because we don't have grass all year? So
It's finished on what's called haylage or baleage, which is if you've ever been driving around upstate and you see those big round rolls of plastic wrapped hay.
Mm-hmm.
So they wrap them in plastic and they start to ferment in the same way that you would ferment, grains to brew beer. And it frees up a lot more of the nutrients and there's a lot higher sugar content. It tastes better to the animal, so they want to eat more of it. And so in the same way that you finish, beef on grain, they might be out on pasture and then you switch them to grain to finish them. The same is true of finishing these grass-fed animals, and they are finished on this haylage. When there's not grass out, they will be just fed like regular hay until they reach their finishing weight. Uh-huh. Does that answer your question?
No, it does answer my question. Okay. I'm just wondering, so that's basically all grass-fed beef is finished on the haylage.
It should be.
Okay.
Not everybody does it.
And what do they do? What are they doing?
They're just feeding it whatever they're feeding it and decide it's big enough, and then they send it to the slaughterhouse. Those are guys that are doing it wrong.
Uh-huh.
Their animals aren't as good as they could be.
Okay.
If that makes any
sense. What are the breeds that are most raised the most here in the New York area? Is that also Black Angus and Hereford? Those seem to be the two most popular.
I don't actually know the answer, but like, are there a more diversity of breeds here than, let's say, in the Midwest?
Oh, yeah.
I would absolutely think so.
Yeah, because they're so close to England.
What is the Italian breed that's
Chianina,
so popular? Yeah.
Chianina.
Yeah.
Chianina and Piedmontese also and Piedmontese, is the other one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which has like a double muscle gene, which makes it tender kind of thing. With the
See?
Other one is the
He's Belgian a meat dealer.
Blue. Oh, pork, really.
Yeah.
Beef we buy by the, case like everybody else because uh-huh. we could never move all the ground.
Right.
Although we have been talking about a burger shop up in Harlem with Joe Bastianich.
Really?
That would be like an educational nonprofit, but until that happens.
Meaning that you would employ local youth to mm-hmm. run it? It would be like a Jamie Oliver experiment. Remember when he was running those kitchens in Britain? Which
absolutely.
I just thought was so brilliant of him.
And we were wanting to be, they haven't decided what to do, but like the placement firm, like Heritage Foods would help those graduates, like mm-hmm. if they had been there for 6 months or whatever,
right.
Find jobs, in cities where they would want to live or
Would you do
New
that
York.
Through the Harlem Children's Zone? Do you know that group?
Well, I mean,
this
really, we just want to be part
Sorry.
Of it.
Yeah.
They might decide that we can't be, so.
No, I think Jeffrey Canada would definitely go for this idea.
Yeah?
I think so, yeah. Anyway, let's go back to Tom and talking about the Brooklyn Kitchen Labs.
Yep.
I love that it's labs. So who else is going to be in there with you, or is it just yous guys, yous and your partner, Harry, and...
Well, you have your assistant butcher who's been with you for a while.
Yeah,
now, right?
we have a real crew of people. So basically, uh-huh. The core of the labs are going to be Harry Rosenblum and his wife Taylor, and then my wife is actually going to be working. She's working for the labs as a media developer.
Annalise, the Brooklyn-based founder as
exactly.
well?
Exactly. Annalise Griffin, the Brooklyn-based founder, and my wife. And in addition to that...
We can give her applause.
You just got buried.
Our applause sign is a little late for the crowd. So.
And then there's me, and then there's Brent, who's my... Mm-hmm. My number one guy who came up from Richmond and I got him a job at Diner and I actually even found his apartment for him. Wow. So he's like my indentured servant. And then
he's actually holding an umbrella right outside of Roberta's window.
Yeah.
Right.
And then
with his pedicab.
And then we brought up Brent's best friend, Ben Turley, who joined us at Daughters and is now he just quit Daughters and he's joining us at the Meat Hook.
Uh-huh. So you're from Virginia? Is that how you knew?
No.
Oh, you just, no, they happened to be.
Brent actually wanted to move to New York. He happened upon an ad on Craigslist for a line cook position at Egg. Hmm. And he came up and talked to George Well at Egg. And Brent was working at Belmont Butchery in Richmond, and he was like, "Yeah, I work, you know, at this butcher shop, and I'm really interested in the fact that you guys are doing, you know, some hogs here and stuff like that." He's like, "Well, we do one every other week or something like that, but you should really go talk to my friend Tom." And so he sent him over, and I was like, you know, we went out and had some drinks, and I was like, "Dude, move up here! Like, let's do this. Let's that's the rest is basically history." And so that's my connection to Richmond.
Tom, let's talk for a second about the trend of the DIY home butcher. Yeah. I mean, there was that article in the Times a couple of weeks ago, Patrick, that you and I talked about, that Kim Severson wrote about how, it's gotten so cool to be able to do your own. And what are people going to be buying? I mean, what do they think they're going to be doing?
Why butchering and not?
Why not just plain cooking?
You know what I mean? It just seems like butchering is an unusually.
Are you aiming your classes towards home cooks, or is it for professionals also?
We're going to be offering two different tracks. So we're going to do a sort of like butchering 101, which is not hands on. It's just going to be like, you know, we'll start the beginning of the class with a side of pig or a whole lamb, and then butcher it as we like talk about all the different, issues involved with, local meat production, blah, blah, blah. Just sort of like proper meat in general. And then we're also going to be offering a by application only professional development track, where you will pay a certain amount of money to have one-on-one butchering lessons with us that are going to be really focused around what it is that the person taking the class wants to learn. So we don't have like a sort of pat class, like every class is going to
be. So if Fleischmann's is charging $10,000, I fear to find out what the one-on-one class will cost.
Yeah, Fleischer's is hooking up $10,000 a session.
Right.
I thought that was
it's
a good
for them. Like 3 weeks? It's for 6 weeks.
6 weeks.
It's for 6 weeks. And
this is what I said.
Including your board, I guess.
I think it makes sense. I mean, when I talked to Josh, it makes sense. If you really learn it. When I was in culinary school, they didn't have butchering classes. And that's all I wanted to do, was learn how to butcher for myself, just because I like doing it so much. So there's really nobody. And now you are going to be doing it here in Brooklyn, but there's nobody else really teaching that. And I don't even think in culinary schools, I don't really know what's going on there, but that they're really teaching the essential, really important things about butchering.
I mean, the problem with teaching butchering is you need to have access to a lot of animals to cut up.
Yeah.
And an
outlet to get rid of them. And if they, if somebody, who's just learning, cuts right down the middle of a pork loin and like completely ruins it.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
The restaurant's like,
right. So, I mean, there's a difference between what Josh is teaching and what we're going to do. Like, we're going to offer very focused things. Like, say you're a sous chef or you're a line cook, and you just like decide that I want to learn how to break down a pig because, whatever, your restaurant sends you there, or you just want to do it for yourself, and you have a very clear idea of like what you are going, what the end is, then we'll, sort of teach you in like one or two installments, like as much as we can in as short a period of time, teach you exactly what you want to know. Whereas Josh is actually training people to be all around butchers. So we're doing really focused stuff. He's doing really broad stuff. The broad stuff, like to, learn how to be a butcher, you have to cut up, a big bee butcher. Like, you need to cut up a lot of animals. And the reason why it costs $10,000 is because he has to like bring in a lot of animals for these people to cut up. Mm-hmm. Right. So that they get the practice. But if you're, somebody who can't afford $10,000 and can't afford to take 6 weeks off, but you want to like learn enough to be dangerous, then you'll come to us.
So that's funny.
To be dangerous.
Now tell us, why butchering? I mean, of all of the artisan crafts, I mean, how do you explain this renaissance? Or is it really not as big a renaissance as we think nationally?
Yeah, is this just like a media construct? Or is
I don't know. I live in
happening?
A strange little bubble.
You do. Yeah.
New York City.
Manhattan.
Called Brooklyn. Because believe me, none of this, I live in Manhattan. And if I had my druthers, I'd be out here in Brooklyn in terms of the food scene. It's so much more vibrant here.
Yeah.
I mean, Manhattan is kind of a dead zone now. So
you're saying it's a bubble phenomenon, just to local to our metropolis?
But I see this happening around the country. I mean, I was talking to the Narragansett Creamery, and there's like, they cannot fill the demand for people who want classes.
That's still a bubble, though.
For people who want to learn how to make
cheese.
This is in Wakefield, Rhode Island.
It's definitely an urban phenomenon, mostly because I think that people that live in rural places... like probably have a butcher shop,
especially for deer and all the state inspected.
Right,
they don't need it as much.
Upstate, you have that for deer, but you don't have.
It's not so other and fascinating.
In New York,
right, that's the thing. It's like it's the exoticism that I think is the draw. And
sorry, I'll stop.
it is.
She's like, yes, please do.
It is like that.
We've reached our quota.
That otherness, you know, that exoticism. That. I think only really appeals to people that are in urban environments. And I mean, you know, not to get like too Richard Florida on the whole thing, but there's a lot of people out there who work these, you know, work in cubicles and they're, you know, they do this one thing and they, you know, they're a cog in the machine and, you know, they don't really maybe understand like what it is that they do exactly or they don't do something from the beginning to the end. So
I think
they
that's
see
the
some,
problem is that it's part of a bigger sort of continuum in which they're just a little piece of it. Whereas when you are actually, one of the things in that article by Kim Severson, which I'm sure you read was.
No, I didn't.
Oh, well, anyway. It was
a really good
like,
article.
It was interesting, but at the same time, I sort of wanted to puke because it was like this person that she was quoting extensively was saying, well, I want to be part of the, thank you. I really want to be part of the process of like looking the animal in the eye.
Oh,
I've got to eat meat. I want to, you know, have looked the pig in the eye and know that I've, you know, just plugged it with a 22. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't need that experience. I mean, I don't. And
well
but you have a lot of people.
But that's part of the experience. Sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you.
No, I mean, it really depends
on
the person.
That's what drives a lot of this.
Lot of people have like this sort of like weird like ex-vegetarian liberal guilt where they're just like, well, if I'm going to eat meat, then I want to take responsibility for that. I'm not going to like, you know, shit on anybody's plate about that. Like, I mean, but on the other hand, like, you're right. It is. It gets a little smug and it gets a little weird.
It does. I think it's a little weird. I mean, I think it's good for people to recognize that their food does not come in the plastic tray.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And that raising animals is time consuming, costly, and extremely hard work. That's another thing that I think that most people don't recognize about animal husbandry and agriculture in general.
Actually have a question about the future of agriculture, like on that level. If I mean, I've been wanting to ask this question all day. But like what the future we have had talked about vertical farming and roof gardens and all that. But what would the meat scene look like 300 years from now? I mean, if we did regionalize or localize, like, how do you think, you know, what breeds would we raise? How would we raise them? What animals are best adapted to urban environments? Like, if we really got bad and we really had to eat from our immediate area, like, what would that?
So you're talking about like, you know, if
zombie land,
right? Yeah. So if in the year 3000, we were living in these
after
sort
the
of
apocalypse.
Like, after the apocalypse, we're living in like, these sort of like quasi agricultural urban areas. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously everything would go, you know, back to, you know, smaller animals.
Yeah. I was going to say cows, like, would we be still eating beef as much?
Oh yeah. No, we would eat beef, but we would eat, you know, like we would be eating all these like really tiny pocket steers that, you know, they have all over Britain, you know, like,
is that like the pocket beagle?
Yeah, sort of.
So small, you can fit it in your pocket. Is that where it comes from?
That's right.
I mean, there is a whole like genetic strain of British beef animals that, you know, I saw 20-month-old carcass. I mean, it hadn't been hanging around for 20 months. It was 20 months old when it was slaughtered, which is fairly mature. And the entire animal weighed 375 pounds. It was a steer.
Wow.
And it was a Scottish Highland. And it was a particularly small subset of the Scottish Highland.
Like smaller those look than cool. a pony. Right? Isn't that smaller than a pony?
I think it depends what depends pony you're what talking pony. About.
Well, tell us about your pony.
Well, I mean, a full-size horse is about 1,500 pounds, right? A pony is about 850.
Ooh, what hoof? About horse
on the hoof?
Meat.
We're talking about like we're talking like this is dressed. This is gutted, yeah.
Okay,
just
so why not horse meat? Would we be eating horse meat if it
Americans
came to
Americans don't want to eat horse meat because we're such a horse centric. I mean, I went to Montreal and it's there right next to everything else. Like,
what's it taste like?
I haven't eaten it yet. I smuggled some back across the border and I put it in the freezer because I was too busy to cook it. But
it's rather sweet.
Yeah, everything I've heard of is it's very similar to beef. It's more or less beef.
Tougher?
I mean, obviously, you know, not all horses depends. Are created equal. Yeah, exactly. I mean, maybe they're raising meat horses.
And not thoroughbred ones, yeah.
No. When I was 14, we lived in France for a year. And we tried horse a couple of times. And it was, as I recall, I remember going like, ew, but because being a carnivore, I ate it anyway. And it was, I think I remember my mom having to braise it. I don't recall eating it as a steak. And it was a little bit sweeter
depends
than...
Depends the cut.
Yeah, the cut depends. I mean, every animal is like tender in the same place and tough in the same place.
I just wanted to remind you guys of this piece in the Wall Street Journal yesterday by Jonathan Safran Foer about dog meat. And why? And to speak to your point about how Americans, there are certain things Americans just won't go to.
Like, Tom, you're out of Labrador again? No more Golden Retriever, just Golden Retriever then.
Yeah, what a nice tender Scotty.
No, let's not joke. Let's not go full reet.
When we do the suckling pigs at work, it's the same size as my dog.
Oh,
and I'm
man.
Just like, and when I'm petting my dog, so and I'm like, oh, this would be your hand. And like, and it's the same exact size. So I had a moment of like, where I was doing the suckling pigs, we'd do porchetta. And I was like, you know, I just can't do this anymore. I was like, I need to train somebody else because I was like having these flashbacks. Difficult like things of
you're
like
waking
dealing.
Up in your sleep with a knife over your
but there's
dog.
There's so many other cultures where dog meat, for instance, as Foer points out in the article, dog meat is
good
a very
them.
Regular part of their diet, and horse meat being a regular part of the diet.
Who's
the
diet? Who eats dog?
Chinese, Koreans, a lot
them.
Of Asian people, well, and some
getting,
Africans.
Getting back to you know what you were talking about with like
people.
What is like you know the urban animal going to be like? I mean, you know, in you know Uruguay and places like that, guinea pigs are actually raised like pigs, and they have a little like every kitchen has a little square hole in the floor where they sweep all their scraps, you know, down on the floor and kick them down into a hole where they have a guinea pig in there.
Guinea pig.
Eating their scraps, converting that into meat, and then
every guinea pig. Jack, could you Google the nutritional benefits of guinea pig?
Well,
like
actually,
what
here's
it's like?
A little piece right in here. Hawaiians ate dog brains and blood. Captain Cook ate dog.
Captain Cook?
Yeah, when he was on his. It's been described as complex, gamey, buttery, and floral. But where is the thing about the guinea pigs?
A brief aside, you can actually walk to a supermarket from this location right now and buy a frozen guinea pig to eat. Just FYI.
Is that
and
the
actually,
one on
there's
Graham
a place in
or,
Harlem where you can
Humboldt?
Buy goats.
Are you saying just in the neighborhood there are places that...
Yeah, you can walk over to Food Bazaar and get a frozen guinea pig.
Really?
Yeah. You do guinea pig under a rock. Is the
That's so Wall Street Journal. Like, oh, with these niche animals, you know, what about dog? What? There's always an air of condescension, I think, you know, the way Wall Street Journal deals with food. You know, they always bring up an absurdist side or a side that'll never really work. And anyway.
Oh, I guess it was Katie McLaughlin's
hey, Patrick,
article about
Sorry to cut you guys off. Guinea pig meat is high in protein, low in fat and cholesterol,
yeah,
and is
really
described as being similar to rabbit and some dark meat chicken.
Yeah. Hmm. Rodents, according to Katie McLaughlin, rodents are anathema to good eating for most Americans, but in Ecuador and Peru, cooking a koi or guinea pig on a spit is a tradition akin to roasting a suckling pig, says Maricel Brescia, a chef and historian of Latin American food traditions. Basted with oil, cumin, garlic, and achiote, a red-hued seasoning, the guinea pig is served whole, complete with tiny teeth.
That sounds actually really delicious.
Ooh.
It's kind of making me hungry for a guinea pig.
Do we eat teeth at all? What do we do?
We don't eat teeth.
There's no way to...
Well, if you eat a whole
can anything
bird,
be done to teeth?
Sometimes eat the beak, right? Oh, we have 1 minute. Oh, my God. We only have 1 minute left. Jack.
Jack, well,
take
we,
a
can
single
we go?
Break.
I know. We just talked for an hour.
That whole time is
so much fun.
Well, especially for you, latecomer.
I know. I'm sorry.
Just kidding. It's what okay, was the L not working again?
The L was messed up, and I'm apartment hunting, so I had an appointment before here too.
Where are you moving, Shauna? This
in
is
the
big
neighborhood,
news.
Maybe.
Really? Oh, that's
yep, nice. Humboldt in.
For radio, and, right? That's why.
Humboldt and Skulls, I think it's called, and it's right behind a live poultry killing. Place.
Let's go.
There's a lot of live
there's
poultry
a lot
places
of that,
around
so,
here.
Well, there's one up in Harlem, in my you know, in my neighborhood on 125th and like Frederick Douglass Boulevard or something. Yeah, and they have goats. They have rabbits.
Well, goat. That's a big one. I was wondering what you thought about goat and how much goat breaking down you do. Because that seems like I know Bill Nyman's raising goats.
Americans aren't really into eating goats, but I'm hoping like because they have a really strong flavor.
Goat is so good.
They're delicious. But they have a lot of integument and like they're too collagenous.
It really depends. I mean, again, there's meat breeds and there's, you know, dairy breeds of goat. Mm. And it really depends on what breed it is. I mean, but yeah, I'm hoping, I'm really excited. We're going to start working with a halal slaughterhouse out in Ozone Park.
Oh, nice.
Neat.
That is going to be doing local lamb and goat. And I really would like
really
to.
Really local.
Yeah. I'd really like to educate our customers and get them to appreciate goat. I mean.
So you're doing solely whole animals selling that. So how do you plan on selling the lesser parts?
The off cuts. I always wonder about that.
Well,
too.
Now that you're moving into the neighborhood, Shauna, they're hoping that you'll come by. And I'm going to do my part.
Yeah, Tom, are you going to offer classes in how to, like, in addition to butchering, like when somebody has cut up their, you know, their pig and they're confronted with a chunk of pig that isn't really suitable for a chop or a roast?
Right.
Like, are you going to give them some recipes or how are they going
to
know
what
to do?
Well, when I teach
that?
My classes, I do, you know, give some, you know, I shoot off like some really quick recipe ideas for each and every part of the animal and just talk about the general way that, you know, this needs to be braised, this needs to be roasted, this needs to be cooked hot and fast. But we will be having more in-depth classes about, you know, we're going to do, we actually teach a class that's just on cooking liver. We're going to have another one that'll be more like general offal, including heart and kidney. We have our sausage making class, which is another way to, you know, eat those cuts that aren't chops.
Yeah, bench trim.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Well, this is very interesting.
This has been great. Tom, you'll have to come back.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Well, especially when you guys open and you have specials and stuff like that. We should be your Brooklyn-based.
When are you opening? When is the opening?
We are opening, God willing.
2011 this
year. Yeah. November 11th.
Oh, my God.
So that's right. Very soon.
Dude, that's that's why I'm covered in paint.
So your life's about to end and you'll be there 24 hours a day.
I am already there 24 hours a day. I'm hoping to be there less once
we
get it open.
Is it like a restaurant opening, do you think?
Yeah, because it's taken him forever to get his permits. And
exactly
all
the
same problems.
You're going to go a long time with no vacation, I bet. I mean, you're going to be just 24-7.
I'm going to take my real honeymoon in February.
That's right.
That's a good time to go.
We've all, you know, we know it's going to be a real drag to get, not a drag, but it's going to be a lot of work to get this thing open. So we're all planning on taking little trips in February, March when it's so cold and, you know, it's pretty slow. We're all going to need to be recharged. We can't be burnt out.
And from the butcher shop's perspective, people are going to be able to go in there. I mean, besides the fact they can buy the most beautiful kitchen equipment, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like knives, sets, and coffee, and cups, and all that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Meat thermometers. But then from the meat side, they'll be able to order most of the parts of the cow and pig and chicken and
everything. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Anything and everything.
That a butcher would have.
Yeah.
Cool.
It's just a matter of how much, because we get in the whole animal only, you know, an animal is only made up of so much shank or so much.
Right. Yes,
you know,
there aren't an indefinite number
of flank
steaks.
Is there a schedule that people can go to, like on a website, hey, we're bringing in 2 steer on Friday, so if you want the ribeyes, come by, or is there a newsletter that people could sign up to?
No, I mean, we're going to have a pretty steady rhythm. Like the animals are going to come in every Wednesday and we'll have them broken down by the weekend. And, you know, people can call in and just order what they want. And it's first come, first serve. It's like, if you want it, you got to order it ahead of time. If you want to make sure that it's there. If not, if you come in and you want a flank steak, but we don't have any, I'm happy to like steer you towards a flat iron or another cut of meat that is going to be comparable that you can use in a lot the same way.
What are your hours going to be?
We're going to be open from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Friday. That's for the commuters out there. You know, it's hard to get back from the city and into Brooklyn in time to make it to a lot of places. So we're going to try to stay open as late as
and
possible.
And it's very convenient if you have a car. I mean, there's the McGinnis
parking,
exit.
Right? And, the McGinnis exit. And there's also parking under the BQE that is free in abundance.
Yeah, otherwise, you get everywhere. Off the L train at Lorimer Avenue,
yeah,
right?
Lorimer
walk
stop.
A couple blocks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then during the weekends, we'll be open from 11 to 7 on Saturday and noon to 6 on Sunday.
And one real exciting thing about that neighborhood is, I don't know what to call it.
Besides
to say Williamsburg
is
silly, is, but there is a brew hall, a beer hall opening, kitty corner to you.
Yep, there's going to be, it's
there's a
beer
flea
garden.
Market, beer garden, a flea market. There's, it's an old Italian neighborhood. One shop actually sells monuments of the Madonna and bread. Those are their
two
items.
Oh, yeah, I saw that place,
It's a very interesting, you know, Italian culture from, you know, Salerno, a lot of those people meets, you know, a cutting-edge renaissance, you know, back to the old ways of doing things. So it's a great place, and soon people could spend the whole day there. McCarran Park, great farmer's market, actually, and I bumped into Michael Hurwitz.
Oh, no kidding.
There, and the cheesemakers were there, and they just moved to that neighborhood. So Saturdays in that neighborhood would be great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then once you're all done, you can go to a really amazing bar like the Richardson, which is right around the corner, which we're
Richardson's
really good
amazing.
Yeah. They do really great drinks.
It's really making me want to move to the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And then
also one of the few places you can get George T. Stagg bourbon, which is the best bourbon in the entire world.
Okay.
So and one of the nicer places to sit outside. You know, I'm not a huge fan of sitting outside with traffic and this and there, but even though it's right by the BQE, you get a real nice feeling and you look out to a really cool it's nice energy, certainly, when the weather's nice.
Yeah.
All right, then. Well, this has been the main course, part one. Thank you, Tom Mylan, for joining us today.
Thank
and
you guys for having
we're
me.
We're sponsored by Hearst Ranch. Thank you, Jack Inslee and Nat Wiener.
Yeah,
our
good job, guys.
Engineer,
we'll take a 10-minute break. We'll be back.
Yeah.
Passos no mesmo lugar. Não sei há quanto tempo estou a te buscar. Um segundo eu vou, sabendo e percebendo seu sabor. Tanto tempo a perguntar: por que esperar tanto assim de alguém? Sei.